Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm with critics Lael Lowenstein and Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com. First up, the horror film The Nun, starring Demian Bashir and Thaisa Farmiga, film a spinoff of The Conjuring horror films.
I had a series of visions when I was younger. And after each one ended, the same thought would be stuck in my head.
What did you see?
I saw a nun.
A priest and a nun are at the center of the film The Nun. What did you think of it, Tim?
A young novitiate nun, as she is, hasn't taken her vows yet, which is very important in the context of the film. You're in trouble when a film begins and you're at this sort of gigantic Gothic castle in Romania, and you're like, okay, it's already over. you don't even have to do anything. So this tells the story of where that evil nun comes from. That evil nun pops up in the second Conjuring movie, and of course there's the first Conjuring movie, and we sort of work our way through it. There's even a little moment in this movie where Vera is there. Of course, that little thread that goes back.
That would be Thaisa Farmiga's sister.
Her older sister, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because people always mistake her for a daughter because she's so much younger, but she's not. She's just an older sister.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, this movie walks along the path of telling us where this demonic nun came from. There are all kinds of relics involved and big booms and scares. This is what I like about it. It's a big boom, closed doors, bang on the window kind of movie. Not a whole lot of CGI in this movie. As these movies go, that's the way I like them. Just scare me with somebody jumping up out of a coffin or something like that. And they literally do that in this movie.
I don't know which movie you saw, Tim, but I felt like I was at Knott's Scary Farm.
It was kind of like that, actually.
It was like basically being in a haunted abbey. The whole thing felt like a big wind up to Halloween. Like, you know, we are, of course, in the time of year where we're going to be seeing more and more horror films, and many of them not so good. This was just so, to me, it just felt so hack, so trite, and so cliched. There were moments when I thought to myself, I bet a hand's going to just come right out of that coffin. And yes, it did.
Yeah.
Like, I did. I was hiding sort of under a scarf for some of the movie. Yeah, it's creepy. There's a lot of jump scares, but those are so hack and so easy. Unoriginal, really.
Perhaps unoriginal. But like, for instance, not to give anything away, this is in the trailer. There's a moment when somebody ends up inside a coffin underground. We've seen that moment many, many, many times. You know what? Freaks me out.
Well, it's never good. It's never a good thing.
And watching it.
No good.
I had an MRI the other day. I barely handled that. But the guy in the coffin, that really, really freaked me out. And it's so, you're right, simple hack, but still freaked me out.
And there were just also, frankly, so many holes in the story. Like, you know, what are they trying to do there? They're trying to find evil and banish it. You know, to me, this was a throwback to the tradition of The Exorcist, of the Omen. Probably that's the reason they put Damien Bashir there, because of the name. But, you know, it was just, these are good actors who deserve better, who didn't have much to do but just stand there and pretend to look scared.
Talented stars in this film.
Yes, very talented stars, but with really nothing to do and at the mercy of something pretty trite.
Yeah, what can one say? This is the nature of these films. And I got to tell you, I like these better than the ones that involve all the CGI. Give me an Insidious. Give me an Annabelle with that creepy doll with the head spinning around. Give me one of those any day of the week.
Well, I agree. You can get horror without CGI, but, you know, that doesn't make this any good.
The Nun is written by Gary Dauberman. Corin Hardy is the director. It's rated R in wide release. Next, the action thriller Peppermint. The film is directed by Pierre Morel, who also directed the first Taken film. Chad St. John, the screenwriter. The film stars Jennifer Garner as a Los Angeles area mom who decides to deliver her own brand of vigilante justice. She takes to the streets after her husband and daughter were murdered by a drug cartel and the killers walk free.
If you have a news crew, come on down. And if you have a cell phone and you want to come and take videos, come on down. And if you are the LAPD, this is where the party is. Not going anywhere. Come and get me.
Taking someone with a sweet, warm presence like Jennifer Garner and putting her into this role in The Peppermint, Leo, what'd you think?
Well, let's not forget, Larry, she began as Sydney Bristow in Alias, where she kicked some serious butt in lots of different wigs, and she was pretty tough back then. To me, this felt like a marketing ploy for her to say, look, I'm still tough. I can still do these action movies. Unfortunately, this plot of this movie was so paper thin. You could just wipe yourself with it in the bathroom. I mean, it was just, and frankly, it was no good either. It was absolute crap.
Okay. Look, all right. Action, a thriller, and I think that if you look at the IMDb, it even says drama. The one genre that they should have added to that was comedy, because there are moments in this movie that are just hysterically funny.
Intentional?
No, not intentionally.
Wait a minute.
But funny. Just so funny. And in the room that I was in, people just laughed out loud. And I got to tell you, we all kind of got into it.
I'd like to hear about that because we
were rolling with it. And Jennifer Garner, I will tell you this. She looks great. You believe her when she throws a punch. She gets into a bunch of actual physical fights with these guys. She gets beat up. She gets beat up real bad. She gets cut. She gets shot. And, you know, it's not Atomic Blonde. So she's this woman whose family is killed in this horrible thing, Mexican mafia, all kinds of stuff like that. She goes away for 5 years. She trains. She comes back.
We don't really learn about that
until later. A little bit later.
Very little. Later. That would have been something to show more of. Her character transition.
It's completely unbelievable anyway. It doesn't make any difference. You see her on YouTube. It's all ridiculous. It doesn't make any difference. But at least they say it, you know. And she comes back. She's living on Skid Row. Uh-huh. And, you know, sort of hiding out.
To disappear.
And suddenly the police realize there's no crime on Skid Row. We wonder why. Well, you know, all of that's nuts. But that's the nut. That's what makes it good. It's nuts.
I would have expected something more from the Taken people. I mean, this, you know, first of all, this is basically Taken, you know, with the gender reversed. But It offers absolutely no depth of perspective or of character development.
No.
Poor Jennifer Garner has nothing to do. Yes, she's the central character and she occupies the whole story, but it's not credible to me. And
I'm willing
to have fun with the movie if it actually brings me in.
But it sounds like you thought that she reestablished her action chops in the film.
Exactly. That's,
all right.
That's what she did.
I think it's the only thing she was actually doing. That was pretty much it.
Peppermint is the film starring Jennifer Garner. Pierre Morel is the director. Chad St. John, the screenwriter. It's rated R in wide release. Up next, Sierra Burgess is a Loser, a comedic drama from director Ian Samuels and screenwriter Lindsay Beer. Shannon Purser and Kristen Froseth star in A Case of Mistaken Identity, results in an unexpected romance. The popular girl in high school and the biggest loser must come together to win over their crushes.
I met a guy. We texted. He definitely thinks that I'm someone else.
It's called catfishing, and I'm pretty sure it's illegal.
Oh, my God.
Oh, like Veronica?
That's what I have to live up to? Of all the phone numbers in the world, he texted mine.
You need to tell him the truth.
They're my words. He's falling for me.
This is the feature directorial debut for Ian Samuels. Leo, what'd you think of Sierra Burgess as a Loser?
You know, it's far from perfect, but it's a very endearing film. It's like a sort of a modern day Cyrano de Bergerac story. And gosh, it's been, 25 years since Roxanne, the last take I think we had on the Cyrano story. It's heavy girl, social misfit, falls in love with the quarterback of the team and manages to somehow work it around so that the pretty girl is pretending to send the messages, but she's voicing the poetry behind her.
Yeah, it has to do with the texting universe that we live in. You text people back and forth. He thinks he's texting the pretty girl,
right?
But he's texting her. She goes with the flow. They fall in love over text messages. Eventually, he would like to physically see her. She gets the pretty girl to sit in front of the camera, and Cyrano. But you're right, Roxanne, really, because Roxanne, there is an awareness of what is going on, and they are aware of what's going on. This was written by a young woman, and I'm glad it was written by a young woman. Shades of John Hughes here,
Just a bit, I thought.
But I'm glad it was written by a young woman. Because, you know, John was a guy, and way back in the day, writing all those storylines for Pretty in Pink and the emotions of Molly Ringwald and all the characters she played, coming from that middle-aged guy. I loved all those movies, but when we look back at some of those movies now, you know what I mean?
I felt that way then.
Wait a minute. You didn't like the John Hughes movies. We're gonna
I could enjoy parts of them. I felt parts were and inappropriate in some of the portrayals.
It hit me later. It took a little while for that to settle in on me. I actually wrote an essay about it. So, but here, this young woman writing this, it settles in a little bit easier because there's a perspective there, particularly about her. She's a heavier girl. Mm-hmm. She's really, really, really pretty. And she is having issues with what she looks like and how she exists in the world. And then we've got Alan Ruck from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that too.
So you have these little references there.
It was sweet. It was endearing. There's a great message. I had some trouble with the fact that in a modern day texting and social media universe, that couldn't possibly work. Do you know what I mean?
It didn't feel real.
It didn't feel you. No. It really didn't. But I thought.
And you're the mother of two teenagers, so you're pretty close to that world.
Yeah, exactly. They're on their phones all the time.
The movie is Sierra Burgess is a Loser. The screenwriter is Lindsay Beer. Ian Samuels, making his feature directorial debut. Shannon Purser and Christine Froseth are the stars. It's rated PG-13, and the film is streaming on Netflix. City of Joy, a new documentary which takes us to the Congo and a center there that works with people. Lael, share with us about City of Joy.
Okay, Larry. This, to me, is one of the most important films of the week, and I really hope people will take a look at it. It's a documentary about an educational and rehabilitation center in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where women who have been victims of sexual violence go to recover. And
this is a country that has a horrible rate of sexual violence.
Yeah, these are women that have been as girls and young women and different ages. They've been raped, assaulted. They've watched their families be murdered in front of them. It's unbelievably psychologically traumatizing what they've been through. And thanks to a local gynecologist, a doctor named Dr. Dennis Mukwege, and a human rights activist, Christine Schuyler DeShriver, these women are given a place to go to and recover. Eve Ensler, the author of the Vagina Monologues and also the activist, becomes very involved in this project, and she was really the driving force in sort of getting this documentary out there. What's so compelling about this film is that the women speak from the heart. They share their stories. They share their stories with each other, and they help each other to heal. And some of it is really grueling. It's some of the most horrific stuff you can imagine. I want to say also, this isn't a film that's just for women. It's for anyone who cares about human rights. But it certainly has a powerful message for women, and Eve Ensler's presence and getting these women to be able to be more comfortable just with their femininity, their sexuality, to journey back to themselves and accept themselves as human beings after essentially just many of them wanting to kill themselves, you know, from what they've been through. It has a very, this sounds crazy, but it actually has a very uplifting message, very hopeful message. And there's a lovely coda at the end of the film. The women are shown, you know, having many of them gone through this process for several years at the City of Joy Center, where they're healing and helping each other. They've become activists themselves. And there's one woman in particular I just want to mention. Her name is Jane. She is one of the most compelling and moving people I've ever seen in a film. And her story is the sort of cornerstone of it. It's the centerpiece of the film. And it's told just with her direct address to the camera, to a few other women. And it's absolutely chilling. You don't need to see what happened. You just need to hear it from her. And because of the way the film itself has built up to that moment, you are left absolutely shattered and spellbound. It's stunning.
And the resilience that you're describing in these women has got to be, as you say, uplifting at the same time.
It's inspiring. It's incredibly motivational, and it's very, very powerful.
City of Joy, the documentary we're talking about, written and directed by Madeline Gavin. It's streaming on Netflix. City of Joy is unrated. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the Chinese animated film Next Gen and many other movies. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with critics Tim Cockshell and Leo Lowenstein. Coming up later this hour, we're going to get reports from the festival Telluride up in Colorado. Find out about some of the top films there. Claudia Puig was there and loved a number of the films. We'll hear what she has to say, as well as The Frame's John Horn, as they're back in Southern California sharing their thoughts on Telluride. We also remember Burt Reynolds, who was the number one box office star for about a 5-6 year period there. And not long after that, his career just fell apart. And then he had a comeback with Boogie Nights, the film of 20 years ago. We'll talk about Burt Reynolds and his legacy a little bit later. Also want to mention there is a wide release film this week that is not screening for critics. God Bless the Broken Road is a drama starring Lindsay Pulsifer and Mackenzie Moss. Also features former NFL San Diego Charger player LaDainian Tomlinson. Harold Cronk is the director and co-screenwriter, but the film was not shown for critics. The Chinese animated film Next Gen comes from first-time writer-directors Kevin Adams and Joe Cassander. It stars Charlene Yee and John Krasinski. Let's hear what our Film Week critic Charles Solomon had to say about it.
For some time, Larry, the Chinese have hoped to acquire what they call the soft power Japan has gained from its anime and manga. But instead of taking an original story, a Chinese story, and presenting it in a way that it can appeal to greater audiences, they just take bits and pieces of other films and reshuffle them. In this case, it's pieces of The Iron Giant, Big Hero 6, WALL-E, Up, Inside Out, and the second Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. There is an alienated young girl named May. She doesn't have any friends. Her father abandoned them. Her mother doesn't have time for her. She meets 7723, a secret robot that was built to combat the evil plans of a Steve Jobs character. You can give the dialogue with the characters along with them because it's so familiar and so predictable. And all this money and time and talent has created essentially a swamp of cliches and scenes from other better movies. It's just a waste.
We're talking about Next Gen. Charles Solomon weighing in. Quite a voice cast on this. Jason Sudeikis, Constance Wu, Michael Pena. Tim, what do you think of Next Gen?
Well, you know, it's a very strange thing. If you had never seen any of the films that Charles just mentioned, Big Hero 6 and all that kind of stuff, you'd watch this movie and you'd think, oh, this is a nice little movie. Except that since we all have seen all of those movies, you can't help but make those connections. Chinese, very interesting thing going on in this movie. You watch this movie, you have all these characters that are ostensibly sort of Western characters. Yet this movie looks completely and totally like a Japanese animated film with no Japanese people in it. It's bizarre. And I'll tell you another thing that's odd about this film. There weren't any brown people in this movie at all. I watched this movie twice. Watched it and watched it and watched it. Even when our central character was walking through a crowd, none of the other little animated people in the crowd were like Latino or black or anything. And I'm thinking that that has something to do with the nature of the animators and where they're from. It's Chinese, right? And maybe they haven't connected to that just yet, you know? It's a really weird thing to see.
But the animated characters, what country are they supposed to be in?
They're Western. They're American characters. You know, they're our little lead girl, you know, Caucasian girl, and all the other characters and all this kind of stuff. But you know, you watch this movie, I'm like, there are literally no brown characters in this animation. It's the strangest thing. Other than that, everything that Charles says is true. It's just a remake of a number of other better films.
Next Gen, the Chinese animated film. It's unrated and it's streaming on Netflix. Kusama Infinity, a documentary that's written and directed by Heather Lenz, making her feature directorial debut. Leo, what'd you think?
Oh, I thought this was an excellent documentary. Kusama, of course, is the artist who grew up in Japan, had a fairly restrictive and repressive childhood, and was discouraged from becoming an artist by her parents. Later, she made her way to America, made contact with Georgia O'Keeffe, who gave her some encouragement, and began to do work on her own. She's known for her series of dots, her sort of endless repetition of these motifs, and of course the infinity room with the mirrors that's currently at the Broad Theater, Broad Museum. It's a remarkable film because it opened up a world to me that I hadn't known about her, and it described actually an interesting sort of hinting at psychological terms why the repression of her childhood sort of caused her to have this sort of this need to repeat and keep working with these same motifs. A lot of damage, I think, went on in that family, and that sort of enabled her to become the artist that she was.
And drove her in that direction. Post-war, is when she was growing up. Her father married into her mother's family. Her mother's family was the powerful family. Her father had to take her mother's name. This, needless to say, made him fairly unhappy. He cheated a lot. She witnessed a lot of that, and this is what informed a good deal of her work. Left Japan, came to America. This is all 60 years ago. Here's the thing. Mm-hmm. This is all 50 and 60 years ago. This young Japanese woman said, "The hell with all of this."
Right.
And she was a bulldozer in New York.
Right.
She went into galleries with her paintings. Men followed her around like crazy because she was ridiculously beautiful. And she'd have these men, and they'd be carrying her paintings, and she would just take them into the galleries. And she'd say, "This one's going to go over there."
This sounds like a dramatic film, not just a documentary.
It could be. And by the way, she's still alive, still working, and she is the best-selling living painter on the planet right now. For the most money and the most pain.
Also just interesting to hear how, as a woman, she would come up with these fascinating ideas, the mirrors, the various things, and they would be stolen by other artists. They would be purloined. And so she had the double problem of being a woman, being Japanese, and being, being discriminated against because other guys could get in there first. So.
Kusama Infinity is the documentary about Yayoi Kusama, the artist. It's at the New Art Theater in West L.A., unrated. Heather Lenz is the director, making her feature directorial debut. Diane is a horror crime film. It's written and directed by Michael Mongillo. Jason Alan Smith and Carly Avers star in the film. Tim?
Yeah. Starts off pretty good and then gets a little squishy toward the end. We have this veteran, a contemporary veteran. He has a bad leg from the war, very quiet, plainly suffering from PTSD. He finds the body of a young woman in his backyard one morning, calls the police, and obviously the police think, hey, he might have done it. So the question of the film becomes, did he or did he not kill this young woman? And we work our way through that. That PTSD thing that's going on in him takes us inside his mind quite a lot. And we work out the subtle mystery. It gets really squishy in the middle and doesn't stick the landing at all. I like this actor, though. Jason Alan Smith, very, very good. And the young woman, Carly Avers, who plays opposite him, also very good. Good performances in a not particularly good movie.
Lael, what do you think of Diane?
Yeah, I liked it even less, I think. I felt it was... it sort of worked around the question of did he or didn't he kill her by, this how traumatized was he as from his veterans experiences. I didn't think it actually was any sort of great piece of original filmmaking. It tried to do some things with the desaturated color and leaving some questions open. But I thought on the whole it sort of fell very, very thin.
Diane, from Michael Mongillo, the director and writer, is unrated. It's at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in West Hollywood. The Apparition, a French drama, stars Vincent London. It's written and directed by Xavier Giannoli. It's unrated. Tim?
Yeah, so it's interesting. A film set in the contemporary world, and it's about whether or not a young woman has seen an apparition of the Virgin Mary. We have this reporter, a journalist, a war journalist, who's seen some horrible things and has particularly just experienced a particularly tough tragedy, who's called in by the Vatican to go and investigate this. This is what he does. They believe that this guy, he's agnostic, for one thing, so he's outside the system. He'll go in, he'll investigate this and see whether or not this young woman has, in fact, seen an apparition of the Virgin Mary. A whole little cult has built up around her. She's incredibly beautiful, and she's a novitiate. And the story wanders into all of that with these powerful, mostly men at the Vatican making these decisions about whether or not. Here's the problem that I have with this movie. This movie is more horrifying to me than that actual nun movie, the nun movie we talked about before. Because in the context of this movie, this present day movie, all sorts of forces are being marshaled to examine and question whether or not this young woman has seen the Virgin Mary. Here's the thing. She didn't. No, she hasn't seen the Virgin Mary. And this movie doesn't seem to know that. This movie doesn't seem to know that this is all insane. She hasn't seen an apparition of the Virgin Mary. She most unequivocally has not. And this movie wants to play around with that idea. Now, and Larry, you'll remember this in the 80s and 70s. People would see donuts and honey buns
tortillas. No, I mean, you'd see all over the place.
It was a thing. It was in the news. People were talking. It was serious for a while. Then it became silly. And now you notice that it's all gone away. This movie doesn't seem to know that that's all gone away. We don't do that anymore.
Well, we had in periods in history where, you know, fairies were seen regularly.
The 20s,
the 20s in the whole spiritualist era. The film is The Apparition. Vincent London stars. It's written and directed by Xavier Giannoli. The film is unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. and the Regal Edwards West Park in Irvine. Age of Summer, a romantic comedy starring Percy Hines-White and Charlotte Sabina. Bill Keighley makes his feature directorial debuts, also the co-screenwriter with David B. Harris. Lael?
This is a sweet and endearing, not particularly great, but certainly pleasant coming-of-age story. It's narrated from the perspective of a boy who's become a man, and looking back on his teenage years, he is yearning to become a junior lifeguard. So there's lots of footage of him on the beach as a teen. He's lost his bike. He's trying to find that, and he's got a crush on a girl. So all the stuff that, you know, a teenage boy might sort of experience in the burgeoning adolescent years of that time. There's a breezy kind of fun sensibility about it. A nice turn by Peter Stormare who we don't see very much anymore, but as a sort of mysterious guy. It's pretty sweet, I think, as these sorts of coming of age movies go. So this week we had a girl coming of age movie and we got a boy coming of age movie. So it's nice comedy.
Age of Summer. Bill Keighley is the director. It's unrated at Lemley's Monica Film Center since it's set in Hermosa Beach. It's, you know, just up the road
from the South Bay.
Yeah. Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. And real quickly, Tim, Cold Skin, which is a Franco-Spanish horror film. Ray Stevenson, David Oakes star. Javier Jens is the director and Jesus Olmo is the screenwriter.
Yeah, this is interesting, particularly because Javier directed one of the worst movies I've ever seen. A movie called The Divide, just a horrible movie, terrible movie. I wish I had.
Is it so bad it's worth seeing?
No. it's that bad. This, on the other hand, is not. Set in 1914 at the Antarctic. A weather person goes out to the lighthouse there where he's supposed to take over the duties with the lighthouse watchman. There's one other person on the island, and they're there for more than a year, these people, right? Now, we find out very quickly that there are these creatures that come in from the sea. They're more or less just zombies, only they come out of the sea. They're kind of blue and sort of aquatic looking. And this is basically a zombie movie set on this island in this lighthouse with these two guys and a bunch of zombies and one of these people, one of these creatures that the lighthouse guy has taken in. She seems to be female, and he's having a relationship with her. And it's all about that, set in 1914. It's actually pretty good. I'm not very much into CGI zombies and stuff like that, but other than that, this is very intense. Ray Stevens is just a wonderful actor. Love me some Ray Stevens. Can't go wrong with him.
Mm-hmm. All right. And Aurora Garrida also stars in the film. Javier Jens is the director. Jesus Olmo, the screenwriter. Cold Skin is unrated. It's at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in West Hollywood. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, yet another critic, Claudia Puig, joins us to talk about the Telluride Film Festival. John Horn, the host of The Frame, he was there in Colorado, too. He'll share his favorites. That's to come right after this.
KPCC podcasts are supported by UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting political pundit and cultural raconteur Fran Lebowitz in conversation with Matt Holzman, Sunday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at the Theater at Ace Hotel. A sharp-tongued social critic and keen observer of the irony of human behavior, Lebowitz is often described as a modern-day Dorothy Parker and is known for her sarcasm, wit, and outrageous positions on current affairs and contemporary culture. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Well, John Horn, host of The Frame, and our Film Week critic Claudia Puig are just back from the Telluride Film Festival in Colorado. It's a beautiful little town known for some wonderful introductions film. John, good to have you with us. Claudia, thank you for joining us as you're on your way to Toronto for yet another big festival. Let's begin with a film that I know you both have much to say about. At Telluride was the debut of Roma, the new film from writer-director Alfonso Cuarón. John, start us off on it.
This is a beautiful film. I mean, it's deeply personal. It's about Alfonso's life growing up with a family that was going through a divorce and his relationship to his caregivers. It stars a non-professional actor as his nanny, Cleo. It's shot in black and white. Alfonso Cuarón did the cinematography. He went through Mexico, through all of his relatives' homes, and reassembled the apartment that he grew up in, grabbing pieces of furniture from various siblings. And it's a beautiful, very personal film. I thought it was the best film up there. Claudia, I suspect you're going to agree.
Did I think it was the best film up there? I think it's the best film this year. I'm going out on a limb. If this one doesn't win Best Picture, I just can't imagine what could possibly be better than this film. Cuarón is a master at visual storytelling. This feels almost like a visual memoir of his life. It's so intimate, and it's very restrained, and yet he kind of meshes the personal and the political, where you have the backdrop of what's going on in Mexico in the early 70s, and it's such a the sound design. He uses this sophisticated Dolby Atmos sound design where you are completely immersed in every scene. It stays with you like a dream, and it's just beautifully acted. Yalitza Aparicio, who is the lead actress who's never acted before, just brings this gentle but stoic and complex, selfless character. She's just amazing. It's just a jewel of a film. It means a lot to me as a Mexican-American, but it will be just completely relatable to everybody around the world. It's just a story of a family that goes much deeper than just, you know, what it seems to be on the surface. And it's just it's 65 millimeter, gorgeous to look at. He shot it himself instead of using his usual cinematographer. It's just it's amazing.
Roma will be released theatrically and streaming on Netflix in early December. They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, a documentary about Orson Welles' efforts to make the film The Other Side of the Wind. John?
I think this is an incredible film. It's made by Morgan Neville, who is a great documentary filmmaker. He made a documentary about Fred Rogers earlier this year. He made 20 Feet from Stardom. This is a movie about the movie that Orson Welles never finished, and it's a masterpiece of filmmaking and editing. Morgan goes back and gets cuts and clips from the unfinished film, which coincidentally is now kind of more or less finished, will come out kind of simultaneously. He talked to participants in the making, or I guess we should say unmaking of the film. The film itself is crazy, and there's this Shakespearean twist where Orson Welles kind of really throws his great friend Peter Bogdanovich under the bus. There are all these betrayals. There's crazy stuff.
Finished off the film.
Yes.
That's the interesting thing.
That's a complex friendship.
There's crazy things like he casts Rich Little, the kind of lowbrow comedian and impersonator, in a lead role. It's an amazing piece of filmmaking. And it's really about kind of the artistic genius of Orson Welles, which kind of, I think, prevented his finishing this film.
That film, by the way, is The Other Side of the Wind, the documentary titled They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. Claudia, a quick word on it?
Yeah, The Other Side of the Wind is also being released at the same time. And he had a very funny thing to say about it in the documentary. He said, you'll either hate or loathe it. pretty funny.
They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, coming out later this year on Netflix. First Man, the story of Neil Armstrong stepping on the moon in 1969. Ryan Gosling stars as Armstrong. Damien Chazelle is the director, John.
Well, the last time we saw Damien Chazelle and Ryan Gosling together, they made La La Land. There's no dancing in this film. I think it's a really beautiful film. I think we all know that Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, unless you believe it was staged. And this is a film not so much about the various technical steps that got him there. It's really about what drove him. And it's a look inside his home life. A lot of people probably don't know that Neil Armstrong, as a parent, lost a young daughter as an infant to cancer. It really is about how he fit into the world, kind of struggling with his marriage, struggling with the death of his daughter. It's gorgeously shot. It does feel like you're inside a lot of these spacecrafts, but it's a really intimate look about Neil Armstrong, the person, and what made him kind of this reluctant hero who traveled all the way to the moon.
First Man, starring Ryan Gosling. The film is going to be released in mid-October. Can You Ever Forgive Me? A biographical comedy drama stars Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant. Mariel Heller, the director. Claudia?
This is Melissa McCarthy in her first dramatic role, and she does a beautiful job. It kind of reminds you of the sort of role that Kathy Bates might have had 20 years ago. Her performance is finely tuned. There are comic moments. She stars with Richard E. Grant, but it's a very melancholy film. It's a very melancholy character, but she still has, you know, this undercurrent of sort of a wry sensibility. It's a very three-dimensional character, and it's a very revealing look at loneliness and creative insecurity.
All right. The film Can You Ever Forgive Me? Mariel Heller directing. And that's going to come out in mid-October. Boy Erased, a biographical drama written and directed by Joel Edgerton and Lucas Hedges, Nicole Kidman, Joel Edgerton star. John?
This is the second movie this year, the first being The Miseducation of Cameron Post, that looks at gay conversion therapy, which still goes on in some states. It's a horrible idea, which is basically you can kind of scare the gay out of LGBTQ kids. It's a very moving film. It's adapted from Garrett Conley's memoir. And it really is sad because Garrett Conley grew up in a fundamentalist Protestant faith, missionary Baptist, and he believed himself to be flawed and separated from God. And he checks himself in to this gay conversion therapy ministry. That fact is kind of fudged a little bit in the movie. It's an incredibly topical film, and I think when you take it and The Miseducation of Cameron Post together, you can see that gay conversion therapy is still a huge problem in the United States. It's a very good film, and I would say Lucas Hedges is really good in the lead role.
The film is Boy Erased. Joel Edgerton, the writer-director, as well as co-star, it's unrated. That will release in early November. We're talking about the films that our critics, John Horn, Claudia Puig, thought were excellent at the Telluride Film Festival, which just concluded. Claudia saw a new film starring Guillaume Canet and Juliette Binoche, Olivier Assayas's Nonfiction. Claudia?
I really like this film. It feels almost like a play. It's very intellectual, thoughtful. It's talky, but in the best possible way. The ensemble of performers you just mentioned, Juliette Binoche, Guillaume Canet, and others are just perfect. It's very Gallic, but it has really, really interesting observations about our digital world, and observations that feel fresh and pithy. And it's for anyone who enjoys, you know, French cinema, I think this is a really good one.
Nonfiction, the release date to be determined. Also, Claudia, you wanted to mention a Puerto Rican film, Fistful of Dirt?
Yes. Well, Sebastian Silva is the filmmaker. He's a Chilean, actually, but he's made The Maid and Crystal Fairy. It's a very neo-realistic style film, and yet it also incorporates this kind of a few elements of magical realism and fantasy in really mesmerizing ways. And it's the DP of the Florida Project, Alexis Zabe, was used, so it's got this very, very realistic look, and it's set in Puerto Rico just after the hurricane. It's the first film that has been that's been produced there since Hurricane Maria devastated it. And it kind of follows this 12-year-old boy who's just an amazing young actor. Right. Again, was not, an established actor. It's very worth seeing.
All right, Fistful of Dirt. It's unrated. We don't know the release date of it. John, quickly, one more. We've got 30 seconds for you to mention
something. I'm going to give you three very quickly.
Okay.
Old Man and the Gun, which is a true story about a bank robber who was robbing banks well into his 70s, stars Robert Redford in what he has said is his last acting role. A documentary called Free Solo about a climber named Alex Honnold who climbs El Capitan without a rope. Absolutely terrifying. That's out on September 28th. And finally, Reversing Roe, which is a Netflix documentary about Roe versus Wade that comes out September 13th.
All right. Very good. John Horn, you'll hear him later today on The Frame here on 89.3 KPCC. And Claudia Puig, our jet-setting film critic from Telluride, she's off to the Toronto International Film Festival. We'll be hearing about that coming up. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by our critics, Leah Lowenstein, Tim Cogshell. Burt Reynolds was a huge star of the late 70s and early 80s. He actually started in television. He headlined two different network series. He was a regular on Gunsmoke. But then in 1972, he really arrives on the big screen with his performance in the film Deliverance. He goes on to star in movies like The Man Who Loved Cat Dancing, Hustle, Gator, Smokey and the Bandit, and its various sequels, the football film Semi-Tough, The Longest Yard, and a number of very popular films. And then his career dissolved, essentially. He was only minor roles in minor films until 1997. Paul Thomas Anderson, with his second film, Boogie Nights, asked Burt Reynolds to play adult filmmaker Jack Horner, who has always made his X-rated films on film. The video era, the VHS era starts and has a huge effect on the X-rated film business. In this scene from Boogie Nights, you've got Burt Reynolds in his Oscar-nominated performance tries convincing Eddie Adams, played by young Mark Wahlberg, to become a porn star.
So what I'm trying to tell you, Eddie, is that it takes a lot of a good old American green stuff to make one of these things, you know what I mean? I mean, you know, you've got your camera, you've got your film, you got your lights, you got your sound, you got your lab costs, you got your developing, you got your syncing, you got your editing. Before you turn around, you spent maybe $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 on a movie.
That's a lot of money.
But your ass is. But if you make a good one, there's practically no end to how much money you can make.
It was an extraordinary return, as I mentioned, Oscar nominated for Best Supporting Actor in that film. He lost out to Robin Williams, by the way. Tim, your thoughts about the legacy of Burt Reynolds?
It's an interesting sort of thing. You think about Burt Reynolds, and Burt Reynolds is a contemporary of Clint Eastwood. Both about the same age, and they came up together, did exactly the same stuff.
The TV star thing.
The westerns, the same thing. Clint goes on to become a fairly noted director and a very, very sort of serious filmmaker. Burt sort of deliberately chose a completely different path. It comes down to this. Burt Reynolds liked fun. If it came down to choosing between profound and entertaining, Burt always chose entertaining.
And he was a great guest, for example, on The Tonight Show. He's quite the storyteller,
too. He was a wonderful storyteller, that sort of Southern charm thing that he had going. But yet he was still a man's man in the context of that, just like Clint Eastwood. And men and women loved him. Burt had fun with his own persona as well, a little bit more fun than, again, some of his contemporaries. So thus, you see those Smokey and the Bandit, the Cannonball Run, all that kind of silly stuff. That was Burt Reynolds. He was actually doing what he wanted to do, and if it didn't make him a serious actor, Marlon Brando and all of that, he was okay with that.
Do you have a favorite film of his, Lael?
Well, of course, Deliverance would be the one that, you know, sticks in my mind as being still chilling even after all these years, that John Borman directed film, Ned Beatty and Burt Reynolds, and that little
Ronnie
tune you
Cox
can never...
Yeah,
still so good. But, you know, Boogie Nights, listening to that clip, Larry, it made me think what a perfect way for him to kind of reference his own persona, because of course he was one of the first men to pose in
Playgirl.
I think it was Cosmopolitan, actually. Or maybe it was Playgirl.
Cosmo. Yeah. It was Cosmo. Okay.
Basically, in his birthday suit, in that moment that he chose to do that, he was also making a decision to, I'm not going to say not be taken seriously as an actor, but that he was aware of his machismo appeal and his sort of beefcake status. So in Boogie Nights, he was really referencing that in many ways, knowing that he had become a pop culture fixture more than a serious actor. And there were films like Sharky's Machine, which he also directed, still really quite good, but known more for The Smokey and the Bandits and some films that didn't do as well, let's say Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. Mm. But he was a moment. He was a moment certainly associated in my mind with that, with the 70s and some tongue-in-cheek.
I'm a big fan of the film Hooper that he did with Sally Field co-starring. Jan Michael Vincent plays the up-and-coming stunt guy. Reynolds is the aging guy whose body is starting to give out on him, who's abused by directors. Charles Grodin plays the sadistic director who wants bigger and bigger stunts in the film that he's doing. And it's all set around Burbank and Hollywood. And I really love it because it really captured that culture. And stunt people love that film because I think Hal Needham directed it, who had been a stuntman. Yeah. And it was sort of loosely based, I believe, on Jock Mahoney, Sally Field's stepfather, his experiences as an aging stuntman. But that's a film that really stands it because it combined that sort of good old boy stuff with a kind of a backstage look at Hollywood.
And he was a stuntman himself, right? Burt Reynolds, wasn't he at one time? I think early on.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't remember that he was a college football
player
star.
Florida State, and injuries shortened his career there in college.
He definitely would have been a pro. I got to tell you, the films he directed Gator, 1976, The End with his very very good friend Dom DeLuise.
Yeah.
They were inseparable for years and years. Him and Dom DeLuise. That is an absolutely hysterical film. Sharky's Machine, you mentioned, Lael, 1981. Which I got to tell people, if you want to see, if you must go see a Burt Reynolds, everybody says Deliverance. Yes, he didn't direct that. He directed Sharky's Machine. That's set in Atlanta. That film is gritty noir.
Right.
It is funny. Bernie Casey in the film. Bernie Casey's death scene in that film is just one of the most wonderful things you ever have seen in your life. And he even knocked off an Elmore Leonard adaptation called Stick that's pretty good too. And people talk about these, how his career sort of went down. Well, maybe none of those movies really made any money, that's for sure. But I got to tell you, Sharky's Machine, totally watchable right now this second. You put it in, you can watch it from beginning to end. And I just don't have any problem with any of those movies.
We don't really have any comparable actor right now, do we? Who sort of, you say, this is the male lead box office star that women are attracted to and guys really feel like he's a guy's guy. Is there anyone comparable?
Good question.
Certainly not with that field of, George Clooney, maybe. But George Clooney is not really a guy you put a gun in his hand that much. Burt was comfortable with a gun in his hand.
Although, when Clooney did, let's say, Batman, he was, I think, in a Burt Reynolds moment there because he was sort of making fun of himself a little bit.
And the reason why I think of George Clooney is because, Burt was not traditionally handsome. He didn't look like Rock Cutson. And if you go way back, Burt would actually, the hair started going 40 years ago.
Right.
And he would do everything he could, sweep it this way and that way and toupees and all that kind of stuff. But somehow he still managed to maintain that allure.
I don't think there is a contemporary equivalent.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have a lot of male stars who have appeal and attract people to box office. I can't think of someone who's sort of like Reynolds in that era where he was riding high. And what a fall after this. He had that decade or even less than a decade run and then virtually disappeared.
And he was never particularly appreciative of Soderbergh bringing him back, PTA bringing him back for Boogie Nights.
Yeah, he didn't like the film. I think he never even saw it.
Yeah.
I think, which is hard to believe for such a terrific performance. Yeah. All right, well, thank you for being with us. Our critics, Lael Lowenstein and Tim Cogshell, from all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend. We're here with you every Friday at 11 and Saturday at noon for Film Week on 89.3 KPCC.